Okay, I think we'll get started. Thank you so much, everyone, for coming to a 9 a.m. Saturday FERC panel. I am personally thrilled to be here, and I'm not a morning person, so I want to start with just introducing myself, and then I'll let each of my panelists introduce themselves and kind of give you all our pitch on why we think FERC is the most important agency in the whole wide world. So my name is Catherine Morehouse. I'm a reporter at Politico, where I've been for almost 2 years covering the power grid. And before Politico, I was at a trade publication called Utility Dive. And so I kind of fell into FERC very, very organically. I did not, you know, go into journalism thinking, oh, I really want to cover the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. But I have definitely really fallen in, just become obsessed with the commission in the past, you know, 2 or 3 years that I've been covering it. And I'll tell you a little bit about why. So FERC, for those of you who don't know, is a regulatory agency that's in charge of ensuring the reliability of the bulk power system. They make sure that rates are just and reasonable. They certify natural gas infrastructure, and all that might sound a little bit wonky, but what it ultimately means for this rapidly evolving power system is that FERC is really in charge of the many, many rules that kind of run the power system that we don't even know about, that we don't even think about. They're the final say in whether a liquefied natural gas terminal gets approved. They're the final say in whether major pipeline infrastructure gets approved. And one of the really big things that they're getting a lot of attention for right now is transmission, because they have a tremendous amount of power over, you know, basically our ability to build out the power grid at the scale that's needed. And if you think about kind of what the Biden administration is trying to do and really what society needs to do to avoid the worst impacts of climate change, is we are looking at taking, you know, the traditional centralized fossil fuel generators, these massive power plants, and turning them into lots of distributed wind and solar farms, which just take up more room. They're it's more, fewer megawatts per, you know, little, for how much room they take up. And that requires a much bigger build-out of the infrastructure that's needed to actually carry that electricity to the customers. And building power lines is really hard, and it's really complicated, and my panelists can speak a lot better to it than I can, but FERC can play a really, really big role in that. And so that's one of the big reasons that I get excited about FERC. There are a few other things that make FERC really important. You know, climate change. We are seeing we're seeing the real impacts of climate change right now. And one of the really big things that impacts is our power systems. We've seen some of the coldest colds across the country. We've seen some of the hottest heat waves. And what that does is it not only damages and puts the physical infrastructure of the grid under unprecedented stress, it also drives up demand. So these utilities and power systems are having to not only, you know, kind of respond to record-breaking demand, they're also having to do it under conditions that they've never faced before. And FERC has a role to play in that as well, because again, they're the ones who, at the end of the day, say, is the system working the way it should? And I think that there is plenty of debate about, you know, I think a lot of people would say it's not. And the system was really, again, built around fossil fuel plants. And another thing that FERC does is it basically runs these organized power markets that take up where most of us get our power. And a lot of those little rules we don't think about, but they have to do with, you know, whether we're able to, how wind and solar get compensated for their contributions to the grid and all of those little things. So I'll stop because I'll start to get too in the weeds if I go on, which I told my panelists we're going to try not to do. So I'll go ahead and pass it to my first panelist, and thank you so much again for coming.
Thank you, Catherine, and thank you for having me here. This is, truly amazing to be able to talk about FERC on a Saturday morning. My name is Matthias Eindegger. I'm with RMI. RMI is an independent, nonpartisan, nonprofit organization, and our mission is to transform the global energy system to secure a clean, secure, zero-carbon future for all. So that's enough marketing. But so coming at this from a climate change perspective and from a decarbonization perspective, and my team specifically working on the U.S. power system, I look at it as in order to decarbonize in this country, we need to do two really big things. One, we need to clean up the current power supply system, all the electricity that is generated to keep the lights on today, by replacing all the fossil generators with zero carbon clean resources, first and foremost, but not exclusively wind and solar. The second thing is to decarbonize the entire economy and not just today's power supply. We need to electrify all the end users that directly burn fossil fuels today. So that is things like heat pumps in buildings, electric vehicles, and also industrial applications. That will require even more clean power, again, first and foremost, not exclusively from wind and solar to power all of that. The good news is that this country especially has energy abundance of renewable resources. There is more than enough wind and solar to go around. One of the issues is that the best of those resources that we're going to need, the best and cheapest, those with the highest potential, are often located where people don't tend to live and consume power. So we have a lot of wind in the interior of the country and off the coast, lots of solar potential pretty much everywhere, but most space for that solar, again, where people don't live. So what we need is to connect all these abundant resources with the places where they're needed the most. And in order to do that, you need a national scale view of the power grid and how it's being planned, how it's being permitted, and how it's being paid for. Unfortunately, that's not really how it works today. The US power system is fairly fragmented with 50 different states and many more different authorities across the country. But FERC is one of the few federal entities that actually has a national view and that can do a lot to help us build and plan that grid that unlocks a zero carbon future for everybody. That's why I care about FERC.
Hello everyone, and thank you very much for inviting me to speak today. My name is Christine Powell. I'm a deputy managing attorney at Burke Justice. My team focuses on FERC, a team of six attorneys. But a little bit about Earth Justice. It was established in 1971. Earth Justice has many goals, but primarily to protect people's health, to preserve natural spaces and wildlife, to advance clean energy, and to combat climate change. The division that I work in has about 45 attorneys focused on climate change issues. And as I mentioned, my team just focuses on FERC work, primarily energy markets and transmission. And prior to Earth Justice, a little bit about me, I was at the California Public Utilities Commission, where I was an ALJ focused on issues such as how to get the state off of gas assets. As you know, California has very aggressive climate change goals. And I also was chief of staff to a couple of commissioners. And then prior to that, I worked at FERC for about 8 years. I work on transmission issues as well as energy market issues. Why I think FERC is important? Well, you know, the FPA, or the Federal Power Act, gives FERC pretty much plenary authority when you look at the Federal Power Act and case law interpreting it. FERC has pretty much plenary authority to regulate transmission expansion rates and as well as wholesale electricity transactions. So what does that mean? Well, that means that, as Mattia said, FERC can regulate the process for building out the transmission infrastructure. There's a lot that FERC can do there. While there are a lot of other entities involved in permitting, FERC does have kind of like the first two pieces of the puzzle, you know, planning and paying, and can really do a lot there. And also FERC regulates the process for interconnecting generators. So a lot that FERC can do there. And then finally, the rules that dictate how generators are going to be dispatched, the market rules that Catherine was talking about earlier, FERC has a lot of authority over those rules. So that's why I think FERC is important.
Thanks. And thanks, Catherine, for the invitation to talk. My name is Arnie Quinn. I'm the Senior Vice President of Regulatory Policy at Vistra Corp. Vistra Corp is a large competitive generator and provider, competitive provider of retail services. So we are not the traditional monopoly utility. We are kind of the competitive version of that. We we compete to get retail customers to serve, and then we use the generation that we own to serve those customers and then sell into these regional markets that everyone has been talking about. Vistra is one of the largest competitive generators in the country, and we are still a fossil generating company, but transitioning that fossil fleet into solar and storage primarily. So we own the largest storage facility in the world. In California, it's 750 megawatts. That's the size of a coal plant. And we've been operating it for a couple of years. And operating on that scale is kind of fascinating to watch. Prior to being at Vistra, I've been at Vistra about 5 years. I was also at the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. I worked in the policy office where we did both the energy market rules, the interconnection and transmission rules. So why is FERC interesting, and why should you all come here on a Saturday morning? The anecdote I shared with Catherine earlier was, when I was at FERC, we were working on an early version of these interconnection rules. Interconnection is the process of getting a new power plant kind of hooked up to the grid, and in a way that you're confident that the grid can kind of withstand the injection of power and get that power to where it needs to go. And it's a complicated process. It's both engineering, technical. There's also a lot of policy rules around it. And as more new renewables have been developed, it's kind of overwhelmed the system. And so there's been kind of this constant stream of reform. So probably eight or so years ago, FERC was doing one of the early iterations of reforming these rules. And I was speaking on a panel at the Energy Bar Association about these new rules. And at exactly the same time, there was a conversation about the Paris Accords in the room right next to us. And I thought, this is going to be a nightmare. We've got the sexy Paris Accords, this thing everyone in the world is talking about, and then I've got the wonkiest of wonky topics, and there's going to be no one in this room. And in fact, my room was overflowed, and the Paris Accord thing was half filled, because the nuts and bolts of how you actually get stuff onto the grid matters a lot more than big national goals that are aspirational, but not implemented. And that's why you all should be here on a Saturday morning.
Thank you. One of the things that I think is so interesting about FERC as a reporter is there are always new rulemakings and new proceedings and new startings of new rulemakings. And all of these rulemakings are wonky, but often so important. They often have such a potential to have a really big impact on, again, how we generate electricity in this country. And so I'm wondering if could speak to, what is something in front of FERC right now that you think has the potential to basically have the biggest impact on our transition to zero emissions resources, on our, journey to fight climate change? What do you think is kind of the biggest impact that FERC either has in front of it or could have if it wanted to, I guess?
I think all of us spoke already to transmission, and Arnie specifically mentioning the connection. So those are the two things on my list, and those are the two rulemakings that are out right now. FERC has a rulemaking on regional transmission planning reform, and a rulemaking proceeding on interconnection. So, and to what Arnie said about the interconnection process, one number that I'd like everybody in this room to be aware of, if you're not already, is 2 terawatts. That by itself might not mean much to you, but that is the amount of new generation, mostly clean wind and solar and storage, that is waiting to get connected to the grid today. And that number, to put it into context, is about twice the number of all generation in the United States online today. So we've got about twice the amount of existing generation, mostly clean, waiting to get connected, but unable to get connected. And that is, in my view, because of two main reasons. One is the grid is just not able to handle it. We haven't been proactive in how we plan it. That's where this regional planning rulemaking comes in to fix that. to moving forward, be more proactive, plan the system and future proof it for this new generation. And the second one, to also update the processes through which these new generators get connected. They are, they have been updated periodically, but they are still from a time that was just not designed for this new reality that we live in. It was designed for fossil generators, for big power plants, maybe coming online, a new one once in a while, not literally thousands of new smaller generators trying to connect to the grid. So the processes need to be updated, and that's where the interconnection rulemaking comes in. So those are the two big things on my list. If you guys want to elaborate on that.
Thank you. Yes, in addition to the fact that we've got a lot of generators waiting to interconnect with IRA, you know, funding a lot of new projects, we also need to build out the grid to get ready for that. And so what we've been able to identify through studies like the NRDC pathway study is that instead of building out at a rate of 1%, that is regional transmission lines, which are lines that span multiple states, we need to up that to like 9%. It's a lot. And so, you know, and another study from Princeton shows that if we don't up that by 9%, then we're not going to be able to realize 80% of the goals that IRA set forth, or at least 80% of the benefits, I should say, that the IRA provides. And I'm assuming everyone knows what IRA means. It's the Inflation Reduction Act, but just in case. And so right now, you know, as Matthias mentioned, there's a rulemaking before FERC to kind of spur transmission development. But FERC, you know, as you know, has four commissioners right now, a short one, which is a Democratic seat. And so, you know, hopefully that seat will get filled soon. So definitely spurring transmission development and interconnection, as Arnie mentioned earlier. But there's also a piece of the interconnection process that FERC should look at now that's not really teed up, and that's participant funding. So because the grid isn't built out, when generators go to interconnect, they're tasked with paying to build high voltage, long distance transmission lines, which basically prices them out of the project in some cases. And the process of them having to pay for it is called participant funding. And so while FERC hasn't really put that before everyone in its rulemaking, we're hoping that nevertheless it deals with it somehow in this process or institutes another rulemaking to deal with, because it's definitely a big issue. And with that, I'll pass it on.
Thanks. And I completely agree with both of you. Those are the two going to be two most impactful things. And maybe I'll just provide a little bit more color on why this isn't easy. And it's not easy both because the permitting side, you know, there's this a lot of shared jurisdiction between the federal government and the states on the permitting side. But the other part of this is there's this very kind of tough policy fundamental at the heart of this. We don't actually have a national policy on climate change. And that is, again, something my company, I personally am chagrined to say out loud, but we don't. And FERC is kind of it's subject to its statutory obligations and limits. So it has to focus. It can't say, oh, that transmission planning will help us reduce climate change. And in fact, in that whole planning notice of proposed rule, that's underlyingly the kind of the premise of what they're trying to do, but they actually can't say the benefit I'm measuring is the reduction in carbon output. They can't do that because there's not a national policy to that. What they can do is say, I'm going to try to support this state's policy, or I'm going to try to recognize this state policy or this corporate policy. But they're doing it in an environment where they have these large regional markets, these multi-state regional markets. And for many of those large multi-state regional markets, there are differences in state policies. So you have some states that are pushing very aggressively to decarbonize. You have other states that are not only, you know, not pushing to decarbonize, but are trying to entrench the fossil generation they have. And the cost allocation part of this is really complicated then. So how do you pay for this transmission that will support one set of states' policies, avoid shifting costs to other states today, but not knowing where the other states' policies will go in the future, And so the participant funding, I'm really glad that you raised participant funding. That's a really hard, again, I think a hard policy question, because on the one hand, it is unfair to say you, generator, have to spend the entire $1 billion cost of a new transmission line. At the same time, you want to make sure that the ultimate customer that drove that new transmission line is bearing some of the costs. And so finding a way to direct the cost to where they belong, but not burdening any individual set of generators with the cost of building out a transmission system that is going to have to be built out at a scale that we haven't ever done. Without a national policy and coordinating a bunch of state policies, that's hard, but also kind of fascinating and interesting.
I'm thrilled you brought up state policy, because I think that when I first started reporting on utilities, I thought that was one of the most interesting pieces of the puzzle. And I started reporting around the time, 2018, 2019, when all of a sudden all of these states were saying, we want 100% clean energy. And, you know, it was kind of boom, 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 back to back. And they started running into, real conflicts with FERC and with the power markets. And I think we're still in that conflict today, where states are kind of realizing the limits of their own control over how they generate electricity, because electricity is generated at such a kind of, you know, bigger scale than just one state. It's on the grid. So I'm wondering if any of you folks could talk a little bit more about that. Where do we see kind of these state climate laws in conflict with FERC, and how do you deal with that?
I mean, I'd also say that the FPA reserves to the states the authority to determine the energy generation mix. So even though states are really pushing the envelope by, some of them are pushing the envelope by having these aggressive renewable portfolio standard goals, well, that's kind of like, that's in their jurisdiction. That's what they're supposed to be doing. And FERC is supposed to be building out transmission and allowing generators to interconnect at the pace at which states are approaching their goals. I mean, that's kind of the way the Federal Power Act is set up. And I think that, you know, in order to make sure that these transmission rates are just and reasonable, FERC has to do in a way that, you know, plans for the expansion and also make sure that the costs are allocated appropriately, which takes time. So in any case, that's how I think that the states are, that their goals should be, how FERC should approach the state goals.
Yeah, no, I think that's well said. And there are a couple tools that FERC has, and I think what we're gonna get into is a kind of a period of experimentation where policy experimentation, where we try different things. So New Jersey is building out their offshore wind, and it's gonna, they have to kind of build up the transmission system within New Jersey to kind of be able to withstand that offshore wind coming onshore. New Jersey volunteered to pay have their consumers pay the cost of that build out. I imagine the state of New Jersey feels like that was too limited of a cost allocation, but was also the only way I think they saw for getting that transmission built out on a timely basis. So there's this thing that FERC calls the state agreement approach, where states can agree, or maybe even a series of states could agree to collectively to pay for the transmission build out. That I think is an experiment we'll keep trying. There's another idea that has been tried more in the West, where and it's more on the competitive transmission development. So a individual transmission developer will say, I want to build a line from Wyoming to California or from New Mexico to California, and I want to then sign up generators to pay for that line themselves. Again, it's kind of this voluntary, I will opt into paying the cost. And that's actually one of the ideas that Vistra and a couple other companies put into the transmission over. Again, it's kind of this cost allocation thing is really hard, so allow people to volunteer. If you're not getting something built because you're still arguing about cost allocation, allow someone to volunteer to pay those costs to get past the deadlock on the cost allocation argument. And I think there's just going to be we will experiment with this, and then there's going to be a debate on how far that can go, whether voluntary I volunteer to pay the cost of this line is going to get us the transmission buildup that we need, or we're going to need that plus some other way to cost allocate on a broader, more socialized basis.
I was just going to add one thing to what Arnie said earlier. The fact that not all the state that we don't have a national climate goal in that sense, and that different states have different policy goals on climate change, is really important. And I want to add to that, even for the states that have very strong climate goals, it's from a, and Christine spoke to some of the decarbonization modeling studies that are out there and that have looked at what this actually looks like implementing these goals, both at a state level and at a national level. And it turns out it's a lot more difficult if everybody goes at it by themselves. If you want to really decarbonize and transition the power system to fully renewable and the entire economy, geographic diversity and economies of scale are your friend. So it's often said, you know, the sun doesn't always shine, the wind doesn't always blow, and obviously that is true. But it also turns out that the wind almost always blows somewhere, and the sun, at least during the day, shines somewhere. Cloud cover is a local phenomenon. And so all those reasons speak for why we need a national plan and for states to coordinate and jointly plan. Again, FERC with some of the rulemakings can really help to achieve that.
Awesome, thank you. I want to shift gears a little bit and talk about environmental justice, because, you know, if you think about what FERC does fundamentally, it's approve infrastructure, right? And we know that infrastructure is often, time and time again, located in the same communities, and that can often, you know, disproportionately cause harm to those communities. So I wanted to hear from anyone who would like to speak to it about, you know, what role should FERC, how should FERC be thinking about environmental justice? How should FERC be thinking about it? How can it improve?
So right now, at least on the Federal Power Act side, FERC hasn't really taken a stance really on environmental justice equity. And some might believe that FERC doesn't have the authority to do that. I disagree. I think there's a case, NAACP v. FERC, that I think demonstrates that FERC does have the authority and the responsibility to make sure that rates are not only just and reasonable, but within the public interest, and has taken into account the public interest when setting rates. And so, as we all know, you know, the energy system has been cited, planned, and implemented in ways that disproportionately disadvantage many Black and Brown communities, low-income communities, and, you know, basically reinforces structural racism. And so, you know, FERC can take that into account when it looks at how the planning system, the transmission system is planned early on to redress some of these inequities. You know, so for example, looking at how a transmission line might reduce the need for a peaker plant somewhere, or if a owner of a peaker plant wants to transition to a hybrid resource to make the transfer of their injection rights, sorry for that really bad jargon, but just to make that process smoother for either that company or to even transfer their rights to another company that has a lot of renewables and that you know, that's already in the interconnection queue. And so, you know, so FERC can kind of get involved there, and also to have a liaison of some sort to facilitate interactions with disadvantaged communities and make sure that they have access to resources to participate at FERC through like intervener compensation programs, which FERC has teed up and hasn't really delivered on. That definitely would move the needle there. And so I think those are a few things that I think FERC can get started with on the FPA side, and Earth Justice and representing NAACP and others have put that into the record, and so we'll see what happens. We're optimistic. And if I could just say one more thing on the cost allocation, the state agreement approach. I mean, I think that if the transmission rule included other benefits that should be considered, then and made them mandatory, for example, your example with New Jersey and building the offshore wind, primarily for the residents, but you know, it's pretty obvious that it will probably benefit New York as well in terms of providing reliability. And so if FERC mandated that for each project, certain reliability benefits were considered, then when it comes to cost allocation, costs would be allocated according to those benefits, right? So people who benefit would be allocated those additional costs instead of just the state that has built the transmission assets.
Yeah, no, I actually agree with that, and I think the when I think of voluntary cost allocation, I do think of it as first you identify the broader social benefits, and then whatever's cost is left over, that's what people are voluntarily to pay. On environmental justice, I think one again to reinforce how interesting FERC is, there was actually, and I haven't actually watched it yet, I've just heard about it, but there was actually a debate at the last meeting yesterday between the two Democratic commissioners about how environmental justice was considered in, I think it was a pipeline case. So super fresh of mind and a good illustration that I can't wait to watch, truly actually can't wait to watch, about how they're grappling with this problem. The other thing I'd say is the other element of environmental justice I think of is this kind of access to clean energy as we're building out clean energy. And there's a lot of local opportunity, you know, there's a lot of local opportunities to make access to clean energy build out more widely accessible to the entire community. And things that FERC can do is, and they've done some of this, is create market opportunities for more distributed energy to participate in markets. So they lower the kind of the cost threshold because there's a revenue opportunity to earn. And doing that, I think, in a small way, could make those distributed energy resources, community solar, more accessible to a wider community of people.
I agree with everything that you two said, and I guess I'll just highlight two things. There are, as Christine said, a lot of historic inequities and injustices embedded in the energy system. So there is both a responsibility and an opportunity to rectify a lot of that. And the impacts of the current system, climate change and also local air pollution, are disproportionately borne by those already most disadvantaged. So by cleaning up the system and planning it in a way that gets those communities on board from the start, and this has often been done smart from the start, we have a real opportunity in front of us to not just address the climate crisis, but to really unlock energy justice and environmental justice in new ways.
Well, thanks. And just to go off what Arnie said, just a quick plug for the FERC meetings. They're really fun. At the third Thursday, I believe, of every month at 10 a.m., but they're often delayed. And if you do want to see, you know, these commissioners have really different opinions, and that's another interesting piece of the puzzle is often these meetings end up in really big debates about some of the biggest questions that our energy system is facing. And you can watch it virtually, so I really recommend tuning in. Anyway, I'm not sponsored by FERC, I swear. I want to talk about kind of another kind of energy resource that I think is getting a little bit more attention lately. I'm talking about kind of more behind-the-meter resources, distributed energy resources. Like, I'm thinking, you know, battery storage that you can connect to your home, rooftop solar, so, you know, your microgrids, and all these technologies that basically kind of siphon the electricity that we're consuming off the grid. So it basically reduces demand on the grid. And there's been kind of a movement within the clean energy renewable space to make sure those resources are better compensated on the grid, because they'll be able to explain it better, but there's a whole system of how we actually deploy the resources that are ultimately used to power our homes and our businesses. And so I wanted to ask you all kind of what you think about FERC's role in basically allowing these resources, and that includes energy efficiency and just reducing demand generally. How can FERC play a role in giving these resources a bigger role on the grid?
I can start. So this was a rulemaking I worked on when I was actually still at FERC. I would say there are really, this is where in FERC's, one of the FERC's rule, and this is again a good example of where FERC can't say, hey, I have a climate policy in mind, so I want to go implement a policy. But they do have a market policy, and the market policy is I want to lower barriers to new resources participating in markets. And the rulemaking to allow distributed energy resources to participate in markets was kind of under the rubric of, really, it's a competition rule. I want to increase competition in the energy markets by creating ensuring that every single regional market creates rules that allow distributed energy resources and aggregations, because they're all really tiny, and the regional markets are used to dealing with, you know, big coal plants. So they want the resource to be of a certain size. So you have to kind of aggregate all of these resources up to a size that the market wants to deal with. And so one, FERC can say, listen, you can't be too strict on how big of a resource you need. You know, it doesn't have to be 50 megawatts. You know, 5 megawatts is fine. It can also deal with the reliability part of that, which is these regional markets work both as a market and a grid operator at the same time. The market really drives the reliability of the grid. These are resources on the distribution system, so you want to make sure that there's visibility so that the market operator knows that in dispatching that aggregation of resources, which could be anywhere on the grid, that you're not only ensuring reliability on the transmission system, but also on the distribution system. The utilities are always going to say, too hard. If you do this, you're gonna burn the wires on the distribution system, and so don't make us do it. This is where I think the role for FERC is to say that is a real issue, but that is an issue that can be dealt with, and we will identify a set of rules, or we'll make the market operator identify a set of rules that addresses the real issue, but does it in a way that still doesn't block participation.
I couldn't agree more with that. Now I want to highlight maybe one thing or provide a perspective on one thing that Arnie mentioned, which is competition. I think that is critical in the market when it comes to allowing distributed resources to provide the services that they can provide. What I want to highlight is from a policy perspective, competition means something different. And what I often unfortunately see in some reporting and in some conversations is that we kind of pit different solutions like distributed energy resources or utility scale resources, different types of resources against each other. And that doesn't tend to be helpful if one really takes the climate crisis seriously and tries to decarbonize. So I really like what you said about competition, Arnie. What we should probably strive for, at least in my perspective, is to create the kind of market rules at a national level that allow all these different resources to provide the services that they can provide, and for us to provide the right guardrails around those markets to deal with any externalities that any of those resources might have and probably do have. There's no such thing as a free lunch. But what I'm trying to say is we need this national perspective, and we need the rules that really allow us all to work together, all different states, all different resources, if we are going to solve this. It's not going to be just one thing. It's going to be a big bag of many different things that we need.
I agree with everything. I just also wanted to know from a practical perspective, if you're wondering which rule we're talking about, it's called Order 2222, and it's already out there. RTOs or regional transmission operators have already filed compliance, they've submitted those filings, and FERC has actually ruled on a couple of them if you want to check it out. One of the main things that we have highlighted is that their compliance dates are really far in the future. And it's troubling. The Mid-Continent ISO proposed a compliance date of 2030 to allow all these distributed energy resources like energy efficiency, battery storage to aggregate and participate in the market, and we think 2030 is way too late.
Can I say one more
thing? Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and I think the reason that's important is FERC probably has to do series of these. So on energy storage, they did a rulemaking very similar to what we're talking about for distributed resources to say you have to create an opportunity for energy storage to participate in your markets as long as they're technically capable of providing the service they're providing. And you have to kind of recognize that energy storage is physically different than something that's with spinning mass. So we've done that rule. That rule has been implemented in most places. We're most familiar with in California. Once you start operating, then you realize there's a whole set of second generation of issues that have to be addressed. And sometimes the individual regional market operators can just address that by themselves. At some point, I think there will be a rule for FERC to kind of do a second sweep and say, you've all done this different ways. We now have learned the lesson. Let's go harmonize this a little bit and take best practices. And so the longer the implementation date is, the longer it takes to get to that second sweep of market reforms.
Cool, and I'll just ask one last question before going into the Q&A, so get your questions ready. I am excited about this question because I would love to hear what you say, but I want to know what are the kind of the common misconceptions or mistakes or just things that reporters kind of miss when they are reporting on the grid. Maybe they're not reporting on FERC, but they're reporting on FERC adjacent issues. I don't see FERC mentioned that much in the media, what are kind of the things that we as reporters miss or mischaracterize or whatever when it comes to FERC and the power grid?
I think I had already started mentioning one, which is something I sometimes see is a kind of us versus them narrative, which is probably, or I at least imagine, I'm not a journalist, attractive in terms of storytelling, but it's not always helpful when you pit different solutions that are all needed against each other. The other thing I wanted to maybe say, since whenever I get a chance to say this, when I have a captive audience, I like to say this, so I'm going to say it here. Which is, I think, not often really appreciated, is how fragmented the U.S. power system is. It is not even one grid. It is, technically speaking, three different electrically largely isolated grids. There's the East, the West, and then, of course, there's Texas that does its own thing. And then more so, there's different planning authorities which FERC oversees. There's, I think, can remember 11 or 12 different ones across the country that are each charged with regional power system transmission planning in their region. And then some of those are organized wholesale markets. Others are completely vertically integrated territories, the Southeast, large parts of the West, where we have literally dozens of different vertically integrated utilities that plan their system only with their own local territory in mind. And so you can imagine from the kind of techno-economic climate decarbonization perspective that I come from, where all the great sophisticated modeling studies tell us we need to do national scale planning in order to solve this. That's kind of a nightmare. And that's hopefully where FERC comes in with a lot of rules. We talked a lot about already the regional transmission planning rule. That is hopefully going to make this better within those different regions across the country. But what we're still missing is an interregional rule that would make those regions to coordinate among themselves and to plan at a truly national scale. So that's something that is, I think, also really important and often missing still.
So I don't know if this is a misconception per se, but I just want to talk about the fact that there are so many different players. Maybe for me, I have to remember which entity has what role, and so I can imagine for a reporter who's not like in the thick of it at FERC, I'm sure that this is probably a misconception just by virtue of the fact that it's just so complex. And so there are so many different players, like I said. So you obviously have FERC, the regulator, setting regulations at a national scale, recognizing that each part of the country has probably some unique attributes that, has to, so that the rules have to be at a high enough level to recognize that. And some people say, well, that's too wishy-washy, but for, you know, most times I think has a reason for what it does. And then you have these grid operators that are spread across the country, and they're looking specific to their regional needs, and they want to keep the lights on. They're very focused on reliability, but they're interpreting FERC's rules based on their member states and what their unique attributes are. And then you have states themselves that are focused on their individual constituents and what their individual constituents need, so they have different motivations. And then the investor-owned utilities, which basically provide 70% of the power in the country. There are about 170 of them, and they typically have a monopoly over certain areas with captive customers. And they, you know, the way their business model is set up is called cost of service. So they've got, you know, shareholders, and a lot of times they focus on making sure that they can continue to have capital investments, which is building stuff, basically. And that's fine. That's what they're set up to do. So it's not a bad thing. It's just the rules have to be, you know, developed to take that into account so all the goals are aligned, and essentially. So kind of getting to Matias' point about good versus bad, I mean, a lot of times it's just that's their motivation. That's what they're set up to do. So we need to make sure the rules take those things into account. So, you know, just to keep those, you know, different players in mind as you're reporting and as you're trying to figure out what's really at the heart of this issue. Why is this, you know, grid operator or state or FERC or an IOU doing something, to kind of keep that in mind?
Yeah, I think all those are really great points. And Matias, I'm really happy you mentioned the us versus them narrative, because I do feel like that it's really easy. One, it's really easy to tell that story. I'll be perfectly honest, as an industry person, I sometimes get sucked into us versus them and forget, like, oh, we're on the same page as the renewable, you know, because my company still is largely thermal, though we're becoming renewable. Sometimes I'm like, oh, the renewables are on our side on this one. You know, well, of course they are, because, and this is the thing I think that might get lost is, yes, we have all these state programs that encourage, build out of decarbonization, and the states do pay for some of the costs of a resource. So like in Illinois, we are taking our retired coal sites and turning them into storage and solar sites with the support of the state of Illinois. It is a kind of above market price for the renewable energy credit that we're getting. That is useful support, and we wouldn't be doing that without. But it's one component. The rest of it is market revenues that we're going to get from the market in Illinois where we're operating. And I think when we get kind of caught into the us versus them, we also get caught into the state's going to take care of all of it and the market doesn't matter. And for us in Illinois, for those resources, it's kind of a both. It's not an or, it's an and. And sometimes I think the and gets a little lost, and then it kind of feeds into the us versus them sort of narrative.
Awesome. Okay. Anybody have some questions? Remind our reporters first. So here.
Wait a sec. Let's see if the sound microphone will work, and we could.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
My editor.
Turn on. There's the button here. There we go. All right, who had their hands raised? I'll start over here because you're closer to your journals.
Yes.
Okay. Please state your name and your affiliation.
Editors are the best. I'm an editor at the Seattle Times, editing environment coverage. And I had a question about hydropower dams here in the West, and especially the Pacific Northwest. A lot of power is generated from dams on rivers, and we've had some dam removals recently, like the Elwha Dam removal on the Olympic Peninsula in Washington State, the Condit Dam in Oregon came down, and then now we're seeing the beginnings of removal on the Klamath River and several dams that are going to be taken down there. But then there are other dams there's ongoing controversy over dam removal and uses on rivers, such as the Lower Snake River dams in Washington. And the difference is, it seems to be FERC is sort of a big player in whether or not a dam may come down or not because of the ownership structure. You know, these investor utilities that have to go through the FERC process like the Elwha and the Klamath, tends to lead down the road to removal, whereas on like the Columbia and the Snake Rivers, it's just owned and operated by the federal government. I was curious about any thoughts you might have on these different approaches, like to regulation of dams, FERC versus other federal agencies.
Can you briefly restate the question for the audio?
Yeah, so basically, FERC regulations around dams, like is there a difference in how they, sorry, I didn't take a job.
I did not.
Okay. So I did not work on hydroelectric dam licensing, but is it that you're wondering if there's a different policy for federally owned dams versus dams that are owned by investor-owned utilities?
Yeah, like how does the government sort of, it seems to be like from the outsider's perspective, like this different approach, depending on the agency that's sort of regulating or operating the dam.
Right.
So I'm just curious about like the differences in those approaches and what that means in the end for various hydro projects.
You know, I can't speak specifically to, I can't speak to federally, like, to hydroelectric dams, but, so we'd have to get back to you, but I will say, though, at least on the Federal Power Act side of things, the FERC has a different level of jurisdiction over federal agencies that own electric resources. So, for example, the Tennessee Valley Authority, or Bonneville Power Authority, FERC's authority to make them do anything is a little restricted, and Arnie probably knows better, but it is restricted, so I wouldn't be surprised. I'm not sure, but I wouldn't be surprised if FERC has a different level of authority over the dams that other federal agencies own. Did you want to talk about that?
Yeah, I this is also not my specialty at FERC, so I'll tell you just what I picked up overhearing people talk about it. And my understanding of FERC's jurisdiction is that it goes to, it's kind of a wide variety. It's both safety, remediation of the fish and wildlife, and also recreational use of the dam. So it's, my sense is FERC has a fairly wide jurisdiction over a variety of things that a FERC jurisdictional dam has to comply with. I don't think it has over something that is a federal power administration's dam. And so why it is easier for FERC to kind of get to close it versus a federal, like a federal marketing agency, I don't have a lot of expertise in that, but I can say just FERC touches a FERC-regulated dam in a lot of different ways. And so probably a lot of opportunities for people to come together and the variety of safety, environmental remediation, recreational use probably just creates a lot of opportunities for people to negotiate.
We have a question over here.
Hey, Sammy Roth from Los Angeles Times. Whoever said that journalists don't mention FERC as often as they should, even as an energy journalist, I'm guilty of that. The thing that in California I do hear about with FERC on a pretty regular basis that I'm curious to ask you guys about is the role of FERC in setting rates of returns for electric utilities. Especially with California and the rest of the country, but here especially, that so much focus on electrification of vehicles, of homes, of heating, et cetera. There's, and the way electric rates have been rising, I hear a lot these days about, the role of FERC in setting these, arguably quite high rates of return, 10% or more for utility investments, and what is the role of that in driving up electric rates, and is that going to make it much harder to meet electrification goals and ultimately solve climate? So I guess one, I'm curious if there's any real appetite or activity within FERC for discussing that issue of rates of return, and should they be lower than they are, and regardless of that, just interested in what you all think of that issue and whether there should be, action or discussion on that topic.
I can go first.
Okay, I do have something to say.
Yeah, that's a great question. So the question is basically, what is FERC's role in regulating the rate of return on, especially transmission assets? That's the place that most directly comes in. And then how does that higher rate of return feed into higher costs, which will make the progress that we make on decarbonization harder, because as people experience higher bills, they're just going to naturally push back. It's exactly the right question. And I would say I think of it in two ways. There is the regulated way we do this, the kind of very methodical, formula-based, heavily litigated, monopolies rate of return to build new transmission. And that likely does need reform, but it also is subject to so much litigation that it has gotten repeatedly modified. And it really does swing by administration. So FERC traditionally, has tried to kind of maintain an apolitical middle ground, but you definitely get, when it's a more Democratic FERC, more sensitivity to the consumer side. When it's a Republican FERC, a little bit more sensitivity to investor certainty. That's a high level. But I think the other place that this could get more discussion is on the competitive transmission side. And so allowing competitive transmission builders to go in and say, okay, that line was planned, but I would like to compete to be the one to build it and to get a return on it. And there is some question, and there was some work probably 7-ish years ago on whether you would allow a competitive transmission developer to compete over how little they would take on a rate of return. Then there was also a question of whether you'd allow them to compete and get an advantage for committing to not exceeding a certain cost on a project. And FERC made an initial foray into competitive transmission and using that as a way to discipline cost. I think FERC could do more in that area.
And just building off of the transmission piece of rate of return, I would say that as we mentioned earlier, we need more regional projects being built. A lot of the projects now are local projects, and so they're just kind of replacements, and they're not actually adding new capacity to the system or building out the system. And so one thing that advocates suggested to FERC is to make the return on investment lower for these local projects. So that will take the incentive away from IOUs to build those local projects and maybe move it towards competing to build the bigger projects that we need for the energy transition. And then the other thing is kind of aspirational, really. Hawaii has a performance-based approach to determining the cost of service, which includes the rate of return. And so that requires utilities to focus on how, if we meet these public interest, public policy goals, we'll get more of a rate of return. And so it's a win-win for, obviously, the public as well as utility. They're performing a service, if they can be compensated, but it'd be better if they just, focus on the projects that we needed.
Maybe also quickly, because I think it's great and really important question. I agree with everything that's been said, especially with Christine on the kind of regional versus local transmission. What we see is, yes, transmission rates are rising. A lot of that, though, is because utilities tend to build the kind of transmission lines that we don't really want to see, at least from a decarbonization perspective. And they're not building the kinds of lines that we do want to see, regional and interregional, big, high-capacity, long-distance lines. So a lot of that is actually happening from competitive transmission developers right now, as I mentioned, which is great. The other thing that I do want to highlight, though, when we talk about rates, what customers actually see on their bill, that has different components. Transmission is one, and actually often the smallest of those. The other ones are generation and distribution. So another thing that I'd love to see in reporting highlighted is that fact that there are those different components. And yes, when transmission rates are rising, we need to be cognizant of that and make sure that our money actually goes where we need it to go and have benefits. And the other thing, especially for the kinds of regional and interregional transmission lines that we need for decarbonization, very often, in most cases, when we look at both the costs and the benefits of those lines, the benefits far outstrip the costs. In the robust regional planning processes across the country, MISO, the Mid-Continental Independent System Operator, is one example. We see when those regional portfolios get built that they have to meet cost-benefit ratios of at least 1.25, so more benefits than costs by that ratio. ratio, and often they have much more, up to two or three. And so I think looking at the benefit side of the equation in addition to the cost is also really important.
Okay, my name is Natalie Fleming. I'm with Boise State University. And with the massive solar installations, we now know that bare ground is a greater threat than even CO2. And the massive solar installations they have in Cook County, Oregon, if you look at the drought monitor, Cook County, Oregon is now waterproof. We just had the biggest water event probably in 100 years, and yet Cook County, Oregon is completely waterproof. And their small water cycle has been decimated by two things: the massive data centers created by Google and Facebook, and the massive solar installations where they create bare ground. Because the question is, are you taking in account the impact on the local, the small water cycle in the communities when you're doing the massive solar installations? Especially when you look at Virginia, where they're clearing forests to install massive solar throughout the county, because those counties are desperate for money, and so they accept these solar installations, and so they clear their forests. So when you are doing these approvals, are you taking the local ecosystem, the water cycle, the small water cycle into account?
So the question is, does, and I'm going to restate this, does FERC take into account the local impacts, environmental impacts, water use, but I would also add to that land use impacts, using farmland, wildlife impacts when approving these kind of projects. And I'd love to hear Christine's perspective on that too. I'll just offer maybe a few things. Those impacts are really important, and so is, obviously, I think, as we all agree, is climate change, and there will be trade-offs to be made that we need to look at carefully and take into account when it comes to planning and permitting and ultimately paying for all these projects. I would again say there is no such thing as a free lunch with all of these resources. What most modeling today shows is that we need a lot of wind and solar. It's an open question where exactly that's going to go, how that's going to get planned, and how it's going to get built. There are ways, for example, with solar to build agrivoltaics that work with farmland and preserve farmland, where you can have sheep grazing around, where you don't have so many wildlife impacts. Again, it's important to be smart from the start when you plan those projects and take those things into account. And there are some efforts at FERC too when it comes to some of its limited federal siting authority for these projects. That's another rulemaking that's out right now, where I think Christine's organization and others are arguing that you should be taking all of that into account when you plan and permit these projects to make sure that those impacts can be mitigated as much as possible.
Yeah, thank you for the question. I mean, I would say, regardless of who's responsible for the siting or permitting based on the jurisdiction, the route is it really matters, right? Where the clean energy resource is sited. And there are, because of, there's a lot of data available, like the Nature Conservancy, or there's Nature and Natural Conservancy, I always get that wrong, Nature, thank you. They have a fantastic report that outlines places where, construction should just not be built, right? And so it's like it's easy. I think that the data is available for developers to know where to avoid. And I think that, there's so many other areas where the sun is shining and the wind is blowing. Let's just focus on those areas and avoid the areas where, folks were identified as being, off limits for whatever reason. And so FERC, going back to FERC, FERC has very limited authority right now to site and permit lines. It's called backstop authority. It's under FPA 216. And so first, the Department of Energy has to designate a corridor as being in the national interest. And after that happens, if a project is identified and it's under FERC's jurisdiction, FERC can, site the line if a state has denied the developer a permit because the line is in the national interest. Now, mind you, there are other conditions that have to be met. I'm just very speaking at a very high level, but FERC does have limited jurisdiction, and I think that as an advocate, I'd go even further and say, because we need transmission at such a large scale, you know, we're advocating that, you know, potentially there's legislation to consider giving FERC more authority, so just backstop authority for like really high voltage lines, like 1,000 megawatts, just giving FERC authority to do all the siting, because, you know, we really need to get it moving. And actually, those the amount of lines that would be at 1,000 megawatts is actually relatively small when you look at all the lines that states are siting and permitting now, because they've got the distribution lines, like Arnie and Matthias mentioned, which really comprise most of the transmission facilities in the country.
Yeah, I'll just real quick. FERC has very limited jurisdiction over individual like solar facilities. DOE does have a role, not in siting individual facilities, but providing incentives on where to put new facilities. And so DOE in the, I think it was the Inflation Reduction Act, it might have been the Infrastructure Act, did have incentives for like brownfield sites, reclaimed mining sites, reclaimed coal ash ponds. And so the one other element here is if DOE provided more incentives to put the solar in different places that are kind of remedial uses of the land, you'd mitigate a little bit of putting it in places where it will have negative environmental impact.
Hi, I'm Rico Roman, a freelance journalist in Washington State. Thanks for being here. A couple questions. First is, how necessary is hydropower in the transition plan for the Pacific Northwest and West with the interconnected markets? And secondly, statement that there will be trade-offs is something that I've heard several times, and to me, when I hear that, that makes me think of environmental racism. So I wonder, I want to kind of just interrogate that term a bit and push back on that and ask questions about specifically if that's the appropriate term or if it's rather to say that is an acceptance that there will be more environmental racism, because there's not going to be trade-offs for certain people in the population, right? But there certainly will be for others. So perhaps it would behoove us to say, you know, that. So that's just a question I'm open to, no question on that front. So thank you.
Thank you so much. So to repeat the question, you want to kind of probe a little bit what we mean by trade-offs, where we say, we really need clean energy, but we've got communities that may not want the clean energy.
No.
Oh, sorry.
Who are going to be impacted by
right.
In all the whole part. Like, for example, in the Northwest, it's hydropower dams impact on tribal sovereignty and sand, which is, you know, this is like something that means you have many tribes that are dependent on salmon for their culture for millennia. And the dams are threatening their very existence. So is it that the trade-off, that it's their responsibility to bear the burden with their culture, with the sacrifice of their culture, for the sake of the clean energy transition so that people can continue to consume and make profit? Is that the trade-off we're talking about?
So let me see if I got it right this time. So what you're asking is, this energy transition that we're talking about, how it has to be just equitable, does that include maintaining the status quo with the hydroelectric dams, which are harming indigenous populations? Gotcha. Okay. The studies that I've looked at, I'm trying to think back at the studies that I've looked at and whether hydroelectric dams are included. Our focus has more so been like wind, solar, battery, you know, those types of resources, not hydroelectric dams. I can't say that they're not included, but, you know, that's not what we're advocating for. And I think that when we talk about trade-off as it relates to transmission, building out transmission, I think that one of the key parts of the trade-off equation, if you will, is that the local community has to get some benefit. So there's got to be an agreement with the local community if they're going to, you know, continue that route, even though there's opposition. There's got to be some type of agreement where, you know, either you're building a facility that the community wants, or they get a cut on the return. that the developer is getting for building that line. That's happened with the Moraga tribe, I think in California, where they built a line and the agreement with the tribe was, well, now you'll get a return because that's what they discussed and they're okay with. If they weren't okay with that, then something else would need to be worked out. So I think when we're talking about trade-offs, it's not, well, you've got to take one for the team. It's more so, you know, what can we do to make this okay for you? And that's what we do.
That actually happened.
Yes, the Miranda tribe.
I mean, but just broadly speaking, I mean, the planning is that, like, because it seems like the environmental justice piece, it's kind of like, it's a decide, like, well, if it works out, we'll maybe take a truck out and fight out environmental racism, but only if it works out.
To your point, it's not something that's standardized. We are hoping it is something that's standardized. And so with the FERC's backstop authority that's been expanded through the IIJA, they started a rulemaking, and our comments are including engagement plans that have that as a standard practice. Like, you have to do that type of engagement to identify the local benefits that the community agrees to.
Doug Lass from Associated Press, and this may seem like kind of a naive question, but so much of what you were talking about early on was the need for a national plan. Can you just talk about what's getting in the way of a national plan, or what it might take to have a more empowered FERC? Is that entirely a product of its makeup? I think this is probably the politics of that.
Yeah, what's standing in the way of a national plan? There is no national plan. There is currently no agency that has the authority and power to come and with and enforce a national transmission plan, for example. What we do have is regional entities like the regional grid operators that have that authority for their region. And That is great. We don't have that in every region of the country, and we have a mixed bag of progress on that in different regions. So one of the things the FERC regional rulemaking is trying to do is kind of standardize that process and take the good examples from across regions and apply them everywhere. So that will help. And what I said earlier, what is missing is the interregional piece. To actually, FERC would have that authority to come up with a rule that helps and make those regions to coordinate and jointly plan together, neighbors with neighbors, for example. So given the framework that we have, that would be what would really help, that kind of interregional plan.
Yeah, and I will say, FERC did their first reform of transmission planning. It was called Order 1000. It was around 2011 or so. They did exactly what Matthias mentioned, regions planned. As part of that effort, the Eastern Interconnect, you need to understand that an interesting fact about the United States is it's actually three different grids synchronized at a different time. So the Eastern Interconnect, which is basically the eastern half of the United States, really kind of not quite the Rocky Mountains, but Nebraska, Kansas, east, Dakota's east. That's one grid. They did actually look at an Eastern Interconnect transmission plan, so it wasn't national, but it was for that synchronized part of the grid. And it goes back to, I think, something we've already talked about. That included some of these regional transmission operators, so already doing coordinated dispatch across a broad grid, but it also included like the Southeast, where you still had state-regulated, vertically integrated utilities that, and just the regulatory differences made the willingness to actually do Eastern Interconnect wide planning just hard. They did a kind of a tabletop exercise. They did more of a modeling exercise of like, what would this look like? But the FERC would have to say, no, you have to do it on a, they probably wouldn't say national, they'd probably start with an Eastern Interconnect, a Western Interconnect wide planning, and then they would run headlong into states that say, nope, this is my jurisdiction, I wanna do it. That doesn't mean that a stronger FERC couldn't take that on. It probably would be easier if Congress gave them a little bit of backstop to do that, but I think that's an element of what we experienced in, you know, the early 2010s.
Take one more very quick question. Are you curious? Okay, great. I will say the panelists will be available to speak to answer any follow-up questions outside of right now.
Hi, my name is Austin Gaffney. I'm a freelance journalist in Kentucky. My state is very slowly transitioning. We just rejected IRA money. We are digging our heels into fossil fuels. I'm curious if FERC has any power or influence over slowly transitioning states to help us meet a quicker goal or to help us at least match regional states?
Actually, that's a great question. And I really wanted to talk about this. I'm really glad you asked the question. Kentucky is in the market operator for the Mid-Atlantic called PJM. It stands for Pennsylvania, Jersey, Maryland. It actually includes 13 other states, or 10 other states. And it's a great question. And one of the things that actually my company worked on a couple years ago was whether you could apply carbon pricing across not just the states that do carbon pricing in PJM, because there's a regional greenhouse gas initiative. So a handful of states in PJM already price carbon, but it's really inefficient to carbon price across a wide market like PJM, but only have some states that actually price carbon, because you get leakage. I'm talking to environmental journalists, so you guys all understand leakage. So we propose an idea where every state in PJM would voluntarily accept carbon pricing with some transfer payments between the states that were not already regulating carbon. Our idea was the states that do regulate carbon would get a certain windfall, higher carbon revenues. You could maybe offset the higher cost for like a state like Kentucky that doesn't price carbon. And the analysis we did said that you would have a pot of money that would try to get you pretty darn close to being able to compensate the non-carbon pricing regions, and at which point all of the states in PJM would have carbon pricing. That's a really novel idea. We shopped that around. We got a little bit of interest for that idea, but it would really take a multi-state compact that everyone agreed to it. I think if we had some catalyst, and this I think really is at the end to answer your question, you need some catalyst to get people to say, there's an idea out there that would move this along faster, but in a way that respects states' rights, but also advances goals on a regional basis. If you had that catalyst, I think there are ideas out there that would be able to kind of suit the need, but there isn't the catalyst.
And I would just add that environmental justice and equity would need to be built into that to ensure that if the rates do go up, it excludes folks who are disadvantaged communities.
Less one bad.
Cool, well, that's a wrap. Thank you so much, everyone, for coming. Again, 9 a.m. on a Saturday for work. And thank you so much for our panelists. You guys are awesome. Thank you for coming to Boise. I really appreciate it.